Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. I hope you've had a great day today and that you've done all kinds of exciting things. We have a very, to me, a very, very exciting show tonight, very spur of the moment based on current events in state-sponsored organized psychiatric industries. The biggest current events that I can see at the moment is going on, well, not the biggest, but one of the ones that I'm most aware of at the moment is going on at the New York City Department of Mental Health Consumer Advisory Board in the development of some bylaws. So tonight I'd like to be talking about open meeting laws and whether or not you think that penal law, specifically around the idea of menacing and harassment, ought to be added into bylaws of consumer advisory boards for mental health, quote unquote consumer. Like, this is so significant. I'm not even talking about the fact that they're calling us consumers, and that becomes secondary to everything else. Area code 267-521-0167. I do think that area code 718, the line is open.
Hi, I'm Lester Cook. And I'm Angela Cereo.
Hello, Lester and Angela, and thank you for joining me tonight. So I want to just say again, if people want to call in and talk about this, it's area code 267-521-0167. If you live in New York City and you know what's going on, either live in New York City and are concerned about what's going on, or anywhere else in the country or the world and want to join in on this conversation, please do. I also want to give people the page link that I will be commenting from so that people can follow along with me and chime in on that and get this information. It's the New York State Department of State's Committee on Open Government, and the link to that page that tells you about open meeting laws and what qualifies as open meeting laws is www.dos.ny.gov/COOG/openmeetinglawfaq.html. And I'm going to post it on the page as well so that you can link to it. So Lester or Angela, whoever would like to start, would you both just tell people who you are and what you're about before we get into it so people just know if they don't know you, what you're, where you're coming from on these issues?
Well, I've been an advocate for about 30 years now, and I've been on every side of the issues. I worked for the Office of Mental Health for a short time. I have a diagnosis of serious mental illness. I work as a provider now. I'm a certified psychiatric rehabilitation practitioner, and I work at a traditional mental health agency. I was briefly, about a year, the chair of the Consumer Advisory Board. Now, their advisory to, I'm not sure if it's the division or the Department of Mental Health, which is under the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, because mental hygiene includes developmental disabilities isn't the proper term anymore, but it includes that and the Substance Abuse Agency. And we had an entity called the Federation, which I believe is mandated to have input into the local mental health system. By the stakeholders being people with lived experience, people who are in the system now, family members, and even just people in the general community, as well as providers. Well, these councils became provider-dominated over the years.
So the and first the, one you were on, right, the Mental Health Planning Advisory Council, Angela?
That's the state.
That's the state. But you've been doing
that's
this in that capacity since...
Oh, geez. For
what was that,
89? But they didn't exactly dissolve that. They changed the whole structure in Albany. Now, this is totally separate from the CAB. I mean, it's a totally different issue.
Right. Of course it's a totally different issue, but it's just we weren't really talking about the CAB yet. We were just talking about, like, your perspective and
the
kind of work you've done over the years. So I'm just trying to, like, contextualize it for people that you've been involved in these kinds of government conducted advisory.
Yeah, I was
advisory.
A program director for a while.
Right,
of a peer advocacy program called PALS, which stood for Peer Advocates Linking Services. And we got our first contract for PALS from the reinvestment monies that came out when they were downsizing the state institutions. The money was supposed to follow people in the community. The money should have preceded the people in the community to set up community supports, but that's a whole other issue.
Right, there are lots of issues. Okay, and then Lester, would you just give a quick background as to who you are, what you're about, where you're coming from on this end?
I think I'm coming from the perspective of what the intent of the work we were charged to do is supposed to be about.
Right, but before we get, what I'm saying is, I don't know how to better ask this question, just for anybody who doesn't know who you are, so that they have an idea of, before you even get to, like, what the actual issue is here, just who are you and what are you about? Like, in terms of what's your background, what brings you to being involved with any of this?
I'm a psychiatric survivor. I've been a peer advocate now over 15 years. Easy. My reason for doing the work is I actually want to try to change the policy and get rid of the coercion, whether overt or covert. And everybody's voice is important, no matter whose it is. And they have just as much right to have a voice in how we do things as I do. I mean, my argument for open meetings and some of the other stuff that's going on is that you've totally lost all the peer principles that this movement was built on. And yet we can just destroy that.
All right. Okay, so there are at least two different issues here. And so there's open meetings issue. I don't know who wants to start on that or what that's about or why we're even having to talk about open meeting law.
Well, when I first found out that there were mental health councils, this was when I was working for the Office of Mental Health as a temporary full-time worker doing the patient characteristic surveys, overseeing them, the corrections, and putting them in the computer and all that stuff. I did that for the Office of Mental Health. Around the same time, Howie the Harp became the first director of advocacy at Community Access. Now, Howie started a group called the New York City Recipients Coalition, and
now,
that was kind of...
This was in the late 80s, early 90s?
Yes.
Okay.
That group was intended to be a voice with the Department of Mental Health of all the people who wanted... I remember there being family members there, too. And we were trying to get a coherent voice with which to deal with the Department of Mental Health and the Office of Mental Health. And we were listened to. I mean, we were the New York City Recipients Coalition until Howie passed away. And it was just a coalition. I mean, we didn't have bylaws and all that sort of stuff. But when Howie died, I mean, he was the one who expressed our voice to the powers that be. And when he died, there was such a division within that organization that it fell apart because we did not have anything like bylaws. and certain factions tried to take over, and it was a mess, and the whole thing just fell apart. And we've had that problem a lot in New York City. It's very difficult. Howie was unique. I mean, he could keep a really diverse group of people on track.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
No, I know. Not having Howie around anymore is a huge loss. I mean, I think that's a reality that many of us in the movement, I barely knew him. I was very new to this, but I marched in his memorial, and he helped with the Youth Empowerment Association and turning it into Stage 2 Youth Empowerment. And, you know, I think that he definitely, you know, so from my limited interaction, but historically, Howie in California with the Reaching Across series and all of the work that he did and his stance on rights for people and I think that's part of the history of how this development of the Consumer Advisory Board, the distant history.
It is distant history, but it is an evolution to where we are at now,
the divisions are still there, and so...
Well, yeah. But do you know that if Howie were alive today, he would not qualify to become a peer specialist? He didn't have a high school diploma or a GED.
It really is abominable what they have done to what was initially envisioned on every level and the certification. And I'm sure you wouldn't want to be involved with any of it either. The idea of people working in collusion with psychiatric providers as, you know, on teams to go into people's homes and convince them to go into institutions and search them out and cooperating in the co-optee, whatever. It's awful. He's spinning in his grave, I'm sure, about many of these things.
Mm-hmm. No, actually, he's not in a grave. We spread his ashes.
Yes, well.
In most favorite places.
That's true, and the plant, right? The spider plant, right?
The Howie plant, yes.
The Howie plant, yeah. That's true. So that's a bad phrase, but...
There's one of them in the room with me now.
I think that these are important fundamentals for people who may not know any of this, who may just have... You know, in the last several years, walked in and found out that there's a, you know, quote-unquote Consumer Advisory Board, but don't know anything about what happened 20 years ago.
I was trying to get at, Lauren. Through the New York City Recipients Coalition, I found out that there was such a thing as the Federation of Mental Hygiene Councils. There were three in each borough, one for mental health, one for developmental disabilities, and one for addiction services. And they had kind of a structure, but nobody heard about them. Here on Staten Island, there were no consumers there. And this was around the time that Quincy Boykin was...
Consumers meaning, okay. I don't want to interrupt.
Consumers is what they, you know, I get into this with people all the time because in New York City, it's the Department of Consumer Affairs. And it is so ingrained that it's really hard to get rid of it, even though I consider myself a survivor.
But they own the language and they've manipulated everybody into using it. And so I just can't help myself by calling it out. But I also interrupted you at the exact moment that you mentioned Quincy Boykin, and I don't want to let that go. And he is another person who is sorely missed on many, many levels by many, many people, I am sure.
Absolutely.
And so if you want to continue.
He was
with,
the first director of the Office of Consumer Affairs for New York City. Oh, gee, I... Yeah, I've had a bad week myself emotionally here, so I just need to get myself together a little bit.
Sure. And I mean, and I think that this is. I think that there's a lot of powerful information, and I know absolutely, like Vanessa Jackson in her monograph on African American stories of survival, oppression, survival, and recovery, which I'll put the link out to, which is on healingcircles.org. I know Quincy is one of the people that she wrote about. He was a fundamental person to this movement and values and such, and spoke out against so many abuses that were occurring and in so many ways. And so there's a long history of people who have psychiatric histories attempting to make changes in what is going on in New York City Department of Health, Mental Health, whatever they call themselves, because they change their name every 5 minutes too, and merge and unmerge and reorganize themselves, and every time it gets too hot, they just change, you know, who's in charge and pretend like everything that happened yesterday didn't happen, while the same abuses are being carried out all over the place. And so,
well, there are five boroughs in the city. And one of the things that the Consumer Advisory Board is supposed to be is culturally representative of the entire city. I mean, there are two of us from Staten Island. There's only 20 people. How can 20 people be the voice of all the people who have used mental health services in New York City?
Yeah. And that's been another long standing issue of the borough of Staten Island not getting adequate representation inside of things either. And I think that's pretty universal to Staten Island on every level. I don't think it's necessarily limited to mental health, but I do think that so these are the forming issues that kind of led up. And so the Federation used to have board, they had one body that was specific to mental health kinds of things, and then that operated, and you had some
in
kind of leadership.
In each borough, they had a mental health council, and it was pretty much all providers until Quincy pointed out to me that, hey, you have one of those on Staten Island. Join it. They wanted dues, individual dues. So we got rid of that pretty quick. So there started to become this animosity between the city and what we were doing, because this was the first chance, really, that the average person who uses the mental health system could actually sit down across at the table with the providers and tell them what we think of their services and what they need and what they don't need and what they're doing wrong and what's going right. And we never had that voice before. At one point, I was elected co-chair of the Federation for the city. I was the consumer co-chair, and Evelyn Blank was the provider co-chair. They decided that they were getting enough input from providers. The city apparently, oh, gee, here I am speaking for the city, I can't do that. They apparently felt that they wanted to hear from the consumers directly, not filtered through the mental health councils and the provider perspective. So in order to do this, they decided that they were not going to support consumers going to the local mental health council meetings anymore, but they were going to set up a consumer advisory board for the entire city. And myself and Angela Hebner are the two representatives right now from Staten Island. Let's go somewhere else.
Okay, so that gives...
This is very emotional for me. I mean, it really is, because the week I've had, and I've had my own personal family issues going on, so it's really been... wow.
I know, and
but
I'm sorry for your loss.
Support.
Yeah.
Huh?
I said, yeah, and I'm sorry for your loss. That's, there's
no, it wasn't, that made me vulnerable. Okay, look, we're on public
radio
here.
Yeah. I think that, there's long historical issues that are happening here.
Yes.
And so this is what leads to the conversation about an open meeting. Is that these meetings are these meetings of what is now called the Department of Mental Health's Consumer Advisory Board are closed?
I was not at the meeting which took place last Tuesday where they approved the bylaws. We've been trying to work on bylaws since this was formed, and I think it's about 3 years now. We have actually been trying to hammer out the bylaws, and there is just such so many different opinions and difficulty communicating with one another. Some people just are not computer literate enough to keep up with committee workings, and then stuff happens and you miss a couple of days and you don't get your voice in, and then there are the little technical glitches where people's names are left out of the executive committee meetings, and it's interesting.
Right. Okay. And Lester, where are you coming from in all of this?
Well, part of it is the whole penal code thing. I mean, the penal law thing is really got my craw, because that's not how we work with each other. That's not how we help each other. That's not how we support each other. And although I know this is not a traditional peer support meeting, all right, I know whenever a group of us get together in that space, it's peer support. No matter how minute it is, it's there, minutia.
Part of my question is, what occurred in order to have penal law, the law of menacing and aggravated harassment?
Well, allegedly, and I only know because I wasn't there, I wasn't a witness. There is a cab member who says that allegedly someone, even though they took pictures and all kinds of other stuff, someone came up to her at a conference and beat her up.
That's a crime.
So they want to make sure that it's bold enough in there to make you understand that, yeah, if you get a little loud or a little rowdy or whatever, you could be arrested.
Okay,
they can go press charges.
Okay, but there's a big difference between committing a crime of assault and what can be seen as any committee member that exhibits threatening behavior such as abusive yelling, violent language, intimidating physical stance, or gestures will be immediately mandated to leave the meeting. Now,
Wait a minute. What you have there is a draft. Now, my understanding here, too, is none of the people on the cab, including the executive committee, have a copy of the finalized bylaws to check for things like they voted to adopt them, but we don't have a final thing to go over to check for things like typos or misquotes. Mistakes in numbers, or we haven't had a chance to do that because we don't have a final copy yet. Like I said, I wasn't at the meeting. Lester was, I think he kind of tuned out before the end.
Okay, but I mean, I understand that this is a draft, but the idea that even in a draft that there would be a potential for adding in penal law about things like that are so subjective that, I mean, I know that, like, once I got in trouble because I threw my hand in the air... So is that kind of gesture now going to be seen as aggravated harassment? And
no.
Means for being removed from a meeting?
There you go.
So, like, that's what I'm concerned about, that this idea of the subjectiveness of an intimidating physical stance. I know
well,
people...
Well, I think it should just be taken to the executive committee if there is a problem, and let the executive committee decide what to do.
Why are you just taking it to the police? If somebody is breaking a law, why isn't it just going to... I mean, that's what I mean. I don't understand why there has to be special...
I don't think it belongs in the bylaws. I just don't. But my understanding is that they took it out of the body of the document and put it as a footnote. I don't know if that's any better, but that's...
No,
what,
they're only going to take as per Penal Law 420, and they're going to put that at the bottom. See, but my argument is, Angela, this is not how you instill trust, you instill the ability to work together. If I always have to be on guard of what I'm doing or saying or how it may or may not offend you, then what's the purpose of my being there if my voice is going to be dummied down or my voice is going to be silenced in another way? I mean, this is what DeVoice talked about. We get to these tables.
I mean, I don't think
then,
that this is what DeVoice talked about. Because this is different. This is not what DeVoice talked about. But this is about literally the violent language. What's violent language? Is cursing violent language? Is saying this must end violent language? Is revolution violent language? What is violent language? What is an intimidating physical stance? Is somebody standing up at a table an intimidating physical stance? What is a gesture? In New York City, where everybody's talking with their hands, like gestures are going to be now under speculation. If somebody becomes passionate about what they're speaking about and their voice raises, is that going to be abusive yelling? Like these are things that are of concern because they do lead to essentially silencing somebody on some level. But again, whether or not this is the final, and I hope it's not the final. I mean, this is
I'm sure it's not the final. I'm afraid that the final is closer to that than to the final that I drafted up like about it was only like 5 days before the meeting, but it was before the death of my family, and I had a lot going on even before then, and it took me a while to go through the bylaws and make the corrections that I felt were, that would make me comfortable with the way the bylaws were. And one of the things that I did was deleted that entire section.
Yes,
I said that the meetings, it was worded that the meetings shall be closed. And I think I reworded it as the meetings shall generally be closed other than, you know, if somebody wants to come to a meeting and we vote them, they can come. I think that's fair.
No, I don't think that's right, Angela. I think maybe you're trying to be fair, but I think, again, when we look to what the law says that the open meeting laws applies to public bodies, and that term is defined to include, and I'm reading, entities consisting of two or more people that conduct business and perform a governmental function for New York State, for an agency of the state, or public corporations such as cities, counties, towns, villages, and school districts. Committees and subcommittees of these entities are also included within the definition. Consequently, city councils, town boards, village boards of trustees, school boards, commissions, legislative bodies, and committees and subcommittees consisting of members of those groups all fall within the framework of the law. And these meetings are defined as, quote, the official convening of a public body for the purpose of conducting public business. And that this counts for quorums, that if people want to have an executive or a closed session, that has to be requested for in the midst of an open public meeting. And then there's a rule for that. But these advisory board meetings ought to be as part of public business. And then if New York City says, well, it's not part of public business, then it's total sham. Because the whole point of people being there is to influence the way the government is doing business, right?
Yes. We're so advisory to the Division of Mental Health.
Right. So there's the link. They either get to make them open public meetings where all business of two or more people of the government is conducted in public, or they have to fess up to the fact that these things have absolutely no impact on anything and are worthless and that they're not doing it, at which point they have to start doing it, right?
Well, I would like to see them support people going to the mental health councils that do still exist in the boroughs. I mean, a lot of our population can't even afford bus fare, and they used to supply us with Metro cards. And I think these meetings were important because it gave us the chance to interact with providers, for providers to see us when we're at our best rather than at our worst, and in a forum where we can really express our thoughts in a way where I think we frequently get across to people.
I agree with you, and I just think that things like saying that psychiatry is torture and must be abolished can be seen as what do they call it? Violent language. Do you understand? So that it will become a way in which they can devoice us, as Lester was talking before. But I don't think anybody who is ever, you know, that we talk to about in the devoice process, the only reason why I say it's different is because I don't think anybody was ever removed because they were abusively yelling or, you know, being seen as violent in any way. But the fact that this kind of bylaw is put into the process further justifies the idea and the discrimination about people that you would need. Like, does any other advisory board meeting of the New York State Department of Health or New York City Department of Health have in it that, you know, if people, like, start abusively yelling at each other or standing in an intimidating physical stance, that...
Okay, but Lauren, there's something else that I don't think you're looking at here, and that's the fact that Trish Marsick, who this board is basically advisory to because she's head of that Division of Mental Health, gave the power to draw up these bylaws to the CAB. This is coming from the members. This is coming from the people who put in their applications to be CAB members, and the voice of people who are more or less activists is being swallowed up by the people who wanted to be on for whatever reasons they wanted to be on. You know, I'm having flashbacks to what happened after Howie died with the New York City Recipients Coalition. This is us, and some of us not getting it.
So
not
how
kidding,
do you get them to
it.
Get it?
Good question.
I don't know. And yeah, the most impassioned plea to remember our roots and remember we were supposed to be about rights from all along, to that how we work with each other. You know, just didn't work. No matter what I said. And I wrote a lot. I mean, Angela, I think you got the email that I wrote where I basically stated to them, come on now, stop. Stop. Enough.
I mean, and quite frankly, I mean, I just think that again, if there was some kind of assault that occurred, and now people are freaked out because there was some kind of assault, that an assault is criminal and that should never happen. Like that actual physical violence should never occur, and especially in a public meeting, obviously, right? But all of these other things, yelling, language, stance, gesture, none of those are actually address the problem. Like it's part of, again, why are, you know, my fear is that people who are passionate about a particular issue are then going to be seen as menacing or harassing people. Like, what if you know, whoever is in charge says, well, the conversation ends here because we don't want to have it anymore because DOMH said they're not going to do this, so there's no point in us talking about it. There's nothing that we can do. The train has already left the station. Just move on. And,
good question.
And the person says, but no, this is important. This is about human rights. This is about whatever. This is about people. This is about what people need. This is about people what want. This is what people are saying. The train has left the station. We must move on. No, this is about human rights. That's it. You're banned from the meeting. You're off the board. Harassment.
That's my fear. That's exactly what's going to happen.
I mean, I just don't understand. I mean, I've literally been in situations where there have been certain activists who have been accused of, intimidating people by the way that they're looking at somebody, and like the situation was, you know, not that at all, and it was just people perceiving that somebody was intimidating. So if you're like an intimidating kind of person, now you have to worry about, like, if you have an intimidating physical stance. So if I'm 6'4" and, you know, when I say something that that I'm opposed to something and I stand up, now I'm intimidating you because I'm 6 foot. Just my body, my physical stance, the way I'm holding myself, like somebody holding a pen, you know, or a microphone.
No, this has been my argument all along.
If I raise my voice, which I am frequently accused of doing, how
this
many
is what
decibels
I'm saying.
Is too high to be intimidating?
Right, but that's my point.
But Angela, that's exactly what I'm saying. Abusive
that's
yelling.
What I'm saying.
I mean, how many times? How many times? And it's like, and people are passionate. People are having conversations. And so I think this is what goes to Lester's original point of this isn't how we do business. Like when people who are in mutual support coming together as equals to give some kind of input on some level to have a discussion about what it is, but there's a power structure there. There's some people, and I don't even know who's in charge of this or anything, and I'm sure some of them I've hung out with and I like. And so this, again, becomes a difficult situation because there are people that, you know, I don't even know who's there, but if it's New York City, I imagine I know some of these people. And, you know, the bottom line is there are some people who are getting paid and some people who aren't. And the people who are getting paid have expectations from the people who are paying them to have things go in a certain way. And the in addition of the admittance of needing some kind of addition, such as, you know, reminding people that, you know, if you yell or use violent language. I mean, what's violent language? I mean, is violent language, like, literally a threat? Or is violent language something that is offensive to somebody or an unpopular idea that's being discussed?
That's true.
And when it's subjective, how do you know? Because, again, here we are.
It is subjective, yes.
Well, this is why my argument about this is not how we do business to me is very, very, you know, not only really, really important, but, you know, it gets to the heart of what a value system is going to be. Are we going to operate and do business the way we've conducted it for years? The way we were taught to do it from a way back, or are we now going to conduct business in such a way that you're going to offend the people who are passionate about what they do and make sure they never have a seat at the table, because everybody else at the table is more than willing to look the other way and just be there for the man. You know, that's my concern. You know, especially when we start othering ourselves. You know, well, I'm qualified to sit at the table, but you're not.
Or as Howie wouldn't be, right? Because he didn't have the proper educational requirement that's now required.
Oh, no, because you may take us off on a tangent and talk about something totally unrelated and, and then someone's got to pull us back.
Yeah, it says something in there about personal issues. You know, this is about the system and not personal issues. Well, I don't know about you, but to me these issues are personal.
Right. That's what I wanted to mention that in the mission. The CAB will address specific programs and policies of the DOMH and not those issues that concern an individual. And so my response is, but the personal is political. Like, I guess, like, I'm not really expecting DOMH to be taking a feminist stance on how it does policy, but, like, if it did, that would be basic to what it was contributing to and consciousness raising, and that this, I mean, and especially since what they're trying to do is raise the consciousness of those who are involved with psychiatry in any shape or form, then you would think that they would appreciate these kinds of things.
Especially policy making and where they're going to put their money and how the money is going to be used. I mean, that's what an advisory body such as this should be having input into.
It really does seem like there's some fundamental issues. I mean, even under the open meetings law, it says, you know, so if the meeting is public, can people speak? And can I speak at a meeting? And so it says the law is silent with respect to public participation. While it has been advised that a public body does not have to allow the public to speak, many choose to permit public participation. In those instances, it has been advised that a public body must treat all persons in a like manner. For instance, the public body can adopt reasonable rules to ensure fairness, i.e. allowing those who want to speak a specific period of time to express their views. And so, like, that not only should these meetings be open, but there should be a period of public comment at every meeting that is open. And it's been so long since I've even bothered to go to one of these meetings, to be honest with you, that I really probably, you know, don't really have much of a right to say anything because you're all there and at least trying to do something, and I've just kind of, I guess, thrown my hands up in the air and
you wouldn't have been able to come to any of the CAB meetings.
It's
you wouldn't have been able to.
And well, yeah, I guess that's true too.
You didn't
apply
to be a CAB member. You weren't approved by as far as being one of I can't think of the word.
I don't think I was. I ever considered as a CAB member. Was I ever considered that I was rejected that I don't even know?
That would be interesting.
It would be interesting to have Lauren sit on the cab. What do you think, Ange?
Yeah, I don't know. They'd have to change their name.
Applications
first.
Are coming out soon, folks.
But I think that this is pertinent. I think that, you know, there used to be, or at least maybe I just have, like, some kind of romanticized version of what life was like before. I mean, people tell me that all the time. So perhaps, but I do remember a time when those who worked on the inside worked in conjunction with those who worked on the outside, and that we were able to balance off of each other and move our collective agenda forward. And it doesn't seem like there's a collective agenda where those who are working on
the
outside.
No.
There doesn't
Hell
even
no.
seem to be a respect or sometimes even an acknowledgement for what the work on the outside is. And all of the work on the inside seems to, this is an outsider's perspective, but the overwhelming majority of the work that goes on the inside, and this isn't specific to New York City, is that the goal is to maintain the work of the inside. And the goal is no longer about getting people out. But it's to create jobs and maintain positions and keep the administration happy. What is it? The room should feel empty when you're in it. You know?
Now, definitely not anything about an outside-inside agenda here where we're going to work together. It's definitely more those who are willing to work for the man, those who have seen themselves as they've arrived. They're all of a sudden sitting at one policy table, so now all of a sudden they're going to become the oppressor. Because I'm qualified to sit at the table, but you're not.
Well, you know, working in a professional position, it's really a hard line to walk. It really is. I mean, I work for a large not-for-profit, but it's really difficult when you've got all these boundary issues and, you know, you can't be the peer that you once were. Because you're now a professional and you've got HIPAA laws and you've got all sorts of, what do they call them? I'm sorry, I'm now a senior citizen.
I think that's a reality. And it's not only for those who wind up taking on professional roles of working in the system through some accreditation, which I also, have done, and as a psychology professor, like, I'm in this official role where there's stuff that I'm expected to, not this quite the same as providing service, but that there's still this stuff that I have to talk about that I wouldn't talk about otherwise. But in the peer certification process, in the professionalizing of mutual support and self-help, things that were never supposed to be accredited, things that were so natural, so basic, so human, now have this shell over them as something that, and so it, of course it's
as something that can be reimbursed by Medicaid.
Yeah. I mean, in New York, for those of you who are in other states who may have already been dealing with this for, you know, however long you've been dealing with it, New York has successfully fought this off for well over a decade, maybe, you know, and so the fact that it's coming into us now, I think we're all getting a rude awakening about what that means and how compromised people are by the training. Even though you have people intimately involved on some levels with trying to influence the training, there's still all of this other, you know, even if you get five sections of training into the curriculum that the, you know, certification is going to be, there is still all of these other sections of crap that people are subjected to, and because they far outweigh anything that's values-based or what the integrity of, you know, the intentions of the early movement were, it gets washed out and as minor and not nearly as important as record-keeping.
Yeah, exactly. And you have to be computer literate. You have to be. Just to get through the course. And, you know, one of my arguments has been, and I've expressed this to the Office of Mental Health, has been that I have some people where I work who I kind of taken under my wing as advocates, and some of them are so good at connecting with their peers. They're so real. They're so able to get across to people. And yet, they don't have a high school diploma, or their computer. They may even be illiterate, but they, as far as, you know, the written word, being able to read and write, but they connect. They connect. That's what peer support's about.
And certified peer support isn't about any of that. And we, I guess, on many levels, we should stop pretending that it is, or suggesting that it is. And they shouldn't be allowed to suggest that it is. It should be billed as cheap labor, a lesser version of a case manager or something like that. And people coming in contact with anybody who's a peer in these positions ought to know about that and be informed about that. That, you know, oh, this person over here, they're going to say that they're your equal in terms of use a word that is quote-unquote peer, that you've had some kind of shared experience. But you should be aware that they're not really your equal, and they technically work for us, and they have to tell us everything that you're doing, and you don't have any special confidentiality or, like, you know, ease with them because, you know, they call themselves your peer. Just
well,
FYI.
You know, I negotiated my own hours and salary with the agency that I work for, and as such, I'm an independent consultant, even though I do groups and they can bill Medicaid for my work as a certified psychiatric rehabilitation practitioner, which is a certification. And it's so tricky because it's hard if you have a supervisor who is not a peer. You can't really... it's difficult. I mean, I get along great with my supervisor, but it's taken so long to break her in. I really think that if she ever leaves, I'm leaving too.
I think we've all had these conversations wherever we are. If you're not working in a quote unquote peer run organization, that you have to explain, and I've had to explain where I'm coming from and why it's important, you know, and why I'm going to do certain things and why I'm not going to do certain other things, and I think that that's something that people need to be aware of, that not everybody is free to talk, and it's partially because of the pressures that come from the fact that this is all being funded by taxpayer dollars, right?
Yes.
That if this was private money, then most of these issues would not be up for discussion because people would be able to do whatever they want to do. But because this is taxpayer dollars, there are strings attached to it. And you would think that the government would want something that was more authentic and reliable and evidenced for effectiveness than this, you know, than what's being put on, but that's not true. I don't know.
I think it's just not good no matter how you slice it. I just think that the way it's changing and the fact we're not being true to who we were supposed to be or, you know.
Wait a minute. You know, I think that it's good that the city wants to hear from us, that they want to hear our voice. But I think they have some preconceived notions about what our voice should be. And whether consciously or not, I think they're trying to steer it in that direction.
I think the city wanted a particular voice. I think our peers who are sitting around us at the table, with us at the table, drastically want to change that voice. I think we have peers who are very uncomfortable with a rights activist framework. Especially those who would dare sit around and say things like, the only way to recovery is through compliance. Like, well, if they had just been watching them a little better, we wouldn't be where we are now.
If the what?
We began to talk about the mass shootings. And we had someone on the advisory board mention something about the mass shootings. Some of us had mentioned them. And they said, well, if they had watched them a little better than they were, maybe we wouldn't be where we are now. Because I had mentioned the Murphy bill. And they said, well, if they had watched them a little bit better, maybe we wouldn't be where we are now. And I flipped. I mean, flipped. And it's like, you know, there's a particular type of ignorance that Jody, what this voice is morphing into is not what Jody had envisioned. Now, Jody Silva is the former director for the Office of Consumer Affairs at New York City DMH. She specifically came looking for a particular group of voices that were going to be dissident, because she knew those were going to be the voices that would have the answers. I mean, I remember talking to Jody one time, and I said that, you know, somewhere out there was a survey that talked about 80% of folks who use mental health services currently are satisfied. I said, and then there's another 20% and say that, hell no, they're not satisfied at all. And I told Jody, I said, it's in that 20%. You listen to them, and they'll help you find your answers. That's what I said to Jody. And so Jody, I think, was looking to get that 20%, that 20%'s voice to the table. And now this has morphed completely the other way.
Oh, I don't agree with that at this point, Lester. I think we have a way to go, but, you know, we have people who have been hurt in the past in a lot of different ways. And a lot of the people sitting at that table, I mean, if you go by the mental health statistics, we're all a lot of them are trauma survivors,
mm-hmm.
like over 80%.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that trauma is from the mental health system and the treatment that they had.
Absolutely. I think that that it's important for people to understand that that's part of where the pain comes from. And I guess anytime and this is how far out of the loop I am. I didn't even really put two and two together, but about the new administration being there. But I think that there's, I think that there's definitely something to be said for the fact that that there should be inclusiveness inside of what's being presented, and that people should have people should feel safe where they are, obviously, and not feel harassed or like they're around people who are just menacing. I mean, when you really break down and look at menacing, but that this should be open, that these meetings should be open and to the public, and and when you really look at like what menacing means, it means suggesting the presence of danger or threatening, a menacing tone of voice. And so if somebody is talking about opposing psychiatry, you know what I mean? Like, that's my concern, that this is, that what, because that is very threatening to them. If somebody is talking about not having danger to self as a criteria for involuntary psychiatric involvement, that can be very threatening to somebody who wants to see these kinds of things happen, right?
Yeah, and then so the way I see it is that, you know, some of the folks, I never get how you can other yourself. I just don't see it as a real option, but what can I tell you? This is what we're doing now. So it's really frustrating, though, to see this happen. To see, you know.
Well, you know, one thing that bothered me was one of the issues that came up. I don't know. Am I supposed to be talking about what we've talked about at camp meetings?
I mean,
you know, this whole.
It just feels like they want to silence.
One of the issues that one of the CAB members wanted to pursue is getting a higher wage and a union for the peer specialists. Where does that fit in? I don't. It just, you know, it boggles the mind.
Right.
When we started the peer movement, we had no idea that we were going to become a part of the mental health workforce.
Right. And part of when I've thrown the word like union around at points, sometimes sarcastically, sometimes seriously, and when seriously, I've done it in terms of a protective body that will stand behind somebody who is advocating on behalf of somebody to not be forcibly drugged or something like that. Or, you know, in terms of the values of the original movement, if what they're getting in, you know, what they're in trouble with their employer for has something to do with the values of the movement. But, of course, what it always winds up turning into is how do we get more money, how do we get more jobs, how do we get more security, how do we get more for us? Because it is. It's just another... It's another position inside of this monstrous system that is broken, and adding people who have lived experience into this broken system as lesser versions of the staff that exists is just slavery.
Guys, you want to say it? Well, you know you're dying to say it. Murder, slavery, torture. Come on.
Well, I mean, I think it is, and I think that for those who are then, I mean, one of the other main big issues is that when people work in these quote-unquote peer positions, they are outed in these roles and treated differently and distinctly from anybody else, if you're in a traditional psychiatric setting, from any other staff member, down to the idea that other staff members can't have interpersonal relationships with you in the way that they can with each other. That there is a discouragement, and if not like an all-out policy, against communication. And then anything that you do or say is going to be then held up to your, you know, psychiatric history. So if you're angry or, you know, passionate about what it is you're talking about, which they may call, you know, abusive yelling, or violent language, if you, you know, like if you curse, is that, I mean, like what is violent language? What is an intimidating physical stance? The guy who slams his shoe on the table, I mean, is that the gesture that we're talking about? Like...
It just doesn't have its place in any bylaws. Any bylaws, ours or any other, well...
I mean, there's what's criminal, but why do we find it necessary to put an extra reminder of what's criminal into the Consumer Advisory Board? Why is this not the most discriminatory thing that anybody has ever suggested?
Yeah, but when you say it's a discriminatory thing, then people bring up the fact that they were attacked at a conference and that they want it in there so that they feel safe and yada, 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 instead of saying, you know what? But and see, my thing is this. By the time you get to this table, when you start sitting in some of the bigger tables and you're bringing other folks with you, there's a decorum and we know how to act.
Well,
you know,
quite
and
frankly,
we know how to act like an adult.
Attacked,
and if we get it, wait. And
if
we get in trouble
attacked,
as adults.
That's terrible. That's awful, and that's not something that you
what
have,
I mean,
people should feel safe.
Lauren,
but
I'm talking about a respect. Everybody's supposed to respect each other.
Right, but this is another example of how, like, the acts of one go over the acts of everybody. And that, quite frankly, there's a big difference between assault and yelling.
Right. Right, but that's my point. That's my point. Not, you know, yelling is yelling. Assault, you have to actually physically, you know, you're putting someone in a fear when you're going to assault them. So, I mean, to me, it's two different things. I just feel as if there's no respect for anything or anybody, and that they want it their way, and that's it. And they've become quite the group of upstarts and elitists. And that's sad, because, you know, we were a human rights activist movement. We never really did see ourselves better than the next person. We sure the heck didn't other folks. you know, we knew we were all us. We could see ourselves in each other. And now all of a sudden, because you're in a different place than I am, I'm better than you. You don't know what you're doing. You don't know what you're saying.
There is a form of elitism in our movement among some people. Can I give a little example? There was a recent discussion in the community, which was set up by one of the new resource center programs, which are aimed at community reintegration. They set up events in the community that are open not only to us, but to everybody, even though the topics are kind of pushed toward mental health and recovery. And I was at one of these, and we went around at the beginning of the group to introduce ourselves. And there was one person there, I don't even know her name or anything, but she said that she was a peer specialist, and she ran groups and stuff, but she doesn't have, but I don't have a schizo diagnosis. And since I do, I kind of took offense at that. I mean, she's running groups, and she doesn't, you know, she's holding herself above the people in the groups because she's a peer specialist that's being paid. It really rubbed me the wrong way, and I'm glad I had friends in the room at the time because I would have exploded. But if I did explode at her, if I said something, would that have been considered an act of aggression or violence or, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, abusive yelling. Come on, Angela. I mean, let's face it, right? This is not a new, it's like they're almost playing out old conversations. I think it's a way to limit what it is people can.
Oh wait, let me make it clear. This person was not the person who was running the group, who had gotten the group together. She was not working for that agency. She came as a peer from the community utilizing the new service. Okay, but she was working somewhere as a peer specialist.
Right, but whether it's this person or somebody else, I mean, I think it's far away from our roots, I guess, is my point.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
There's got to be some way of how do you truly get people to go back to where we came from? How do we do that?
I think it's partly in the training. I think it's partly what you're exposed to. I think it's partly knowing what your history is. I think all those things count. I think it's who you're mentored by. You know, I think all of those things play a role in how far do you go back to your roots. I don't care who you are.
Some people don't know the roots are there.
Right.
Which is a larger problem.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, some of those people who don't know the roots are there have had better experiences than some of us have when they have been hospitalized or treated against their wills. Because of the work that advocates have done over the years to, well, like the restraint thing, seclusion and restraint, they're trying to get rid of that to some extent. So I don't think they'll ever fully give it up, but I think we've made inroads enough so that people are not penalized for just opening their mouths on an inpatient unit. I'm saying that because I have been in a psychiatric unit, and one of the times that I was there, part of my treatment plan said that I could be isolated and restrained and forced medicated if I were verbally intrusive. And I think that's why the wording in these bylaws is hitting me so rough, because if I could have been force-drugged and penalized for verbally intrusive. It means, you know, trying to talk to one of the staff members when it was inconvenient for them. That's verbally intrusive.
Right. That's exactly what I'm talking about. That's why this is so concerning to me. Abusive yelling,
uh-huh.
violent language, intimidating physical stance, gestures. Like, these are all things that have gotten us locked up or drugged or threatened of being drugged in different parts, at different points. And it's, yes, this is exactly why I'm reacting this way. This is exactly why. That they can say anything and use anything that they want in order to, you know, move whatever agenda they want to move.
Well, I'm glad there are still people like you who are so verbal about it, because I have become quite jaded. I really have. I mean, it's been a long, hard road, and, you know, it's like all of a sudden we're taking these steps backwards, and to me, something like this, where you have to put stuff like that in bylaws, yeah, that's a step backward. And closed meetings,
closed meetings in a world of where we're supposed to be with open meeting laws, and that it's clear that it meets the definitions of open meeting laws. There's no,
I was told that it doesn't.
Wait, you were told that it, like, you specifically were told that it does not meet open
meeting
laws?
By bylaws committee.
I pointed it out to them.
By a bylaws committee member.
Oh, well, you see, this then creates for some kind of action that needs to be taken.
Yeah, it does need to be taken.
I mean, I think that, let's give it a Monday, Tuesday. And, you know, maybe off air, if you want to give me the proper person to contact and see if they're going to stand by that, or just do it now. I mean, I don't care. What's the difference?
Well,
what's
interesting about this is that I guess for some of us, and I won't say all of us, for some of us, we somehow get to policy tables and we forget that there's a whole other group of us also trying to get to those same tables we're at, because the entire movement is oppressed. And then there are some of us who get to those tables and want everybody to join us, and then there are some who get to the tables and say, well, right here, I'm good right now, I'm good, I know what I'm doing, you don't.
Right, but an open meeting, an open meeting wouldn't necessarily mean participation in the meeting, unless there was a public comment, right? It would mean that the meeting would be able to be witnessed, and
yes.
That people would be acting in public.
I wanted to get it opened. I wanted it opened. Lauren, you're not the only one who, I mean, I stood shoulder to shoulder with Angela when she said this. Because I know what it is to go to meetings where they conduct public business and they leave a certain amount of time open for public comment.
So perhaps, I'm not sure what the best step is, next step, and I don't know if I want to, you know, if you know what it is now, then great. If you don't know what it is now, then no rush. Let's, you know, take your time.
Well,
to
I don't know what
it
is now.
I won't know what it is until I see the bylaws.
Yep.
Okay. And I just want to say, I think that's probably...
And bylaws have to be a public document, don't they?
I believe so. I believe so. Area code 970, your line is open.
Hi, Lauren. This is Maria. And I want to say I'm glad that my experience with CAB is about as bizarre as your guys, because I always thought it was my state, my local community that got it wrong. Okay. And throughout the years here in Colorado, I should say there in Denver, it has changed. I used to be a CAB chair.
Mm-hmm.
And I, as chair, used to be able to take anyone on Medicaid. People would know. They would advertise my name. And then anyone who was having a problem can come to me, and I would go directly to the Consumer and Family Affairs person. That was back in early 2000s, and, you know, 2000-2001 area.
Okay.
Of the timeline. But today in Denver, it's even worse than what you think, because not only do they have the CAB meeting, they combined it with the Family Advisory Board. Okay, so, and we both know consumers and families see things differently. And and they only hold the meetings as a matter, you know, it's because they're obligated to. Okay? A lot of the meeting is just, you know, this is information. You know, they go through the quality control, but then they do, you know, an educational part. But the consumer and family director in Denver is often referred to a Nazi because she, if things get out of order, she dismisses the meeting, and that's it. You know, and what is order? Because they offered gift certificates if you attend the meeting, because there is a chair, but there's no, like, when I was chair, we actually took a consensus vote, and we tried to make bylaws. But that kind of situation doesn't exist now, ever since they combined the Consumer and Family Advisory Boards. There is nothing like voting on issues or taking a stand or the consumers together saying, we like this, we don't like that. Or, you know, they might give a quality control report and allow like 5 minutes or maybe 10 minutes for questions, but there's no discussion. There's no debate. So because they offer, and they send the mailing out, and they offer $15 as a gift certificate, they sometimes get a couple hundred people at the meeting, okay? So what is destructive? That maybe there would be, if there's too much noise in the room, you know, side talk or anything like that. Not everybody... turns off their phone and it rings and then you dare answer it while the meeting's there. You can't, you know, it rings, then you leave the room, but you're not to answer it in the room. And she will just stop the meeting, dismiss everybody, no gift certificates, no nothing, and she will say it several times as a warning if things start to get too noisy for her. So, let's face it, as much difficulty as you guys are having, other places are like, I mean,
wow.
You're not even allowed to speak out of turn. Like if somebody from quality control or another area of the, what they call them here, BHOs, are trying to present something to the community, and you interrupt them or there's too much noise and not everybody can hear, it's a big con. But I was a chairperson when there was open debate, where, and it was a totally different consumer and family affairs person, mind you, and we did have debates, and people did present, and what would happen, would ask questions, or say, get personal about their story. Inevitably, meetings were much smaller than we might have gotten 30 people at a meeting, maybe, some months. But if someone would share an experience, and then at least 10 other people would say, yeah, that same thing happened to me. That was a true CAB meeting, because then the consumer advisory director or staff person could say, okay, this apparently is a problem systematically, you know, and let's look further into it. These days, nothing like that happens, but that's what a CAB is supposed to be. Now, in New York City, I'm sure you have hundreds of people. If you're doing a board where there are actually members, assigned members, other than the chair and the co-chair, I can't imagine that.
This is 3 years old.
Oh.
They did away with the federation structure, and this is what the consumer voice has been replaced with, and I'm not happy with it, because just me and Angela Hebner being the only representatives from Staten Island, we certainly can't speak for all the people on Staten Island who use public mental health services. We both do. But
Is your name out there as being a representative of Staten Island?
No. Not as far as I know. They were talking about putting something on the on the website for the city about the CAB, but we haven't even gotten our bylaws down yet. And I don't really see the need for bylaws. I mean, just respect at a meeting is enough. There you go.
Well, and the thing is, if it's a board a lot like a corporation board or a 501c3, I keep on getting those terms.
501c3.
If it's like a nonprofit board, then
it's not. It's not. There's been no talk about incorporating.
No. I understand that. But if it's run like that board, in other words, I'm on a board of a nonprofit, and I represent, because I have family history of in my family, so all the consumer representatives spots were filled. So I am a family representative plus a rural representative too. So technically anyone in where I live, in the county I live, or in the rural area, because there's many counties in the rural area, could come to me and say, could you represent this issue in the rural community for me, okay? Well, they could come to a meeting if they could get there, but they wouldn't necessarily have a vote. But I could represent them and vote the way the community wanted to vote, not necessarily the way myself wanted to vote.
But you'd have to have some structure out in the community in order for you to know what's going on with your peers in the community.
Well, and the thing is, it's for me, because when I did it locally in Denver, it was to be out there to let people know that I was doing this, that I was on the board, and if they did have any issues, you could come to me. I mean, when I was in the CAB, we wanted to get more people coming, so we put up the special box. You have an issue at the drop-in centers. If you have an issue, write it down, and I'll represent it at the board. So those kind of things. But, you know, things evolve and change. And bylaws, you guys can spend the next 5 years over the bylaws. I mean,
it's already been three.
Oh, and so has anything been done? Has any progress been made, or is it you're all spinning your wheels?
There's been some progress, but you know, you have to understand. You said that you're working within your county. Now, New York City has half the population of New York State. As
yes.
far as I know, there's about 60 counties in New York State. Each of those counties has a mental health agency. New York
yes.
City is five counties, half the population of the state, and we have one advisory body.
It's insane.
We have one local government unit for all five counties.
And I bet not even 2% of the people know such a thing exists.
Bingo! I didn't know. I didn't know until I got involved with Quincy Boykin and the Office of Mental Health.
Well, if you guys aren't having heated discussions, then you're not doing your job as a board. I think that's what a board is about. It's about getting the issues on the table. When you're talking about a consumer advisory board, okay, why bylaws are needed for a consumer advisory board other than how to conduct yourself in a meeting? I mean, but is it called, should it be called bylaws? Because you could spend forever trying to get rules and regs. But if people aren't going there and saying, hey, this is an issue and that's an issue, and then when quality report comes in, and people aren't asking questions about that. I mean, I asked questions about the quality control report. A lot of people wished I'd shut up in those CAP meetings, but I wasn't going to because that was one place I had the right to speak out, whether I was the chairperson or not. I mean, very rarely did I not speak in a meeting. Now, once the other director took and combined two meetings, I went maybe once a year because it no longer became, let's hear from the consumer, which is what a CAB is supposed to be about. It became, we're obligated to do this, we'll bribe the consumer for them to come, and then it'll look good. I mean, let's face it, it looks
good. We don't even get bribed to come. We don't have a bribe to come. They serve us chips and water. Are you kidding me? We meet at 5 o'clock at night and we stay till 7, sometimes later, and their idea of bribe is chips and water. I kid you not.
Oh,
or
that's
one of the person one time brought pizza.
That's
crazy. I mean, I still don't think, like, when I was chair, there was no $15 or anything. You came to a meeting because you wanted to know what was going on at your mental health organization, okay? The Medicaid mental health organization. You wanted to know. That's why the meeting sometimes was 10 to 20 people, very small, because there were people who cared. But once they made an incentive and once it was like they wanted to show the state or the feds, whoever counts these things, that they will make an effort to reach the community. But let's face it, if you're put it this way, there are more family members that go than consumers because one particular, and it is a minority in Denver, a group of minority, but they come and literally there'll be out of 100 people, will be half or more of this one particular minority group that goes there. And
you mean
because they heard,
you mean a family member? You mean or
yes.
Okay.
Yes. In other words, both whether it be a family advisory board or a consumer advisory board, when I was involved intimately, where I was part of the hubbub and I was chair, both groups were relatively small, 10 to 20 people meeting every month. Then this new director came in and said, oh, these are small groups of people, so why don't we put them together and get a larger group together? And then one family member, and this is an Asian community in Denver, if you can imagine. So all of a sudden, all these Asian community people decided, hey, we have the right to be here because we're family members. We use our family, and the persons using the services would go too, mind you. But all of a sudden, because they heard about it, they would all show up, okay? And the majority of them...
And they have the right to do that under the open meeting laws.
Absolutely, and that's why they never limited them. And that's when the NAFSE and the director came out, you know, because they would have all these people who would come, and a lot of them didn't know English well, so they would talk among each other, and then there would be this constant roar in the room, and to the point where they finally went and got an interpreter even for the meeting, so they could understand better, which is all good and well and fine, but it was only because a group of these minorities, and there's no, everybody's welcome, I mean, but they weren't expecting that, so all of a sudden, they couldn't tell them not to come because, in fact, it's open to the public, and everybody who is on Medicaid gets these announcements of these meetings, whether they receive mental health services or not. Okay, and yeah, and you were like, huh? Because it's Medicaid. Because anyone on Medicaid, okay, whether they have a mental health diagnosis or not, can receive mental health services at any time. It's a benefit of Medicaid. So if little Johnny and his mother hit a hard spot, and they go to their medical doctor, and the doctor says, well, maybe you should go and get an appointment at the local mental health center, that's how people get involved. But the rule was that they had to send it out to anyone on Medicaid. And at the time they made that rule, they presented it at the meeting, and the director at the time shared that they were getting large amount of phone calls at the 1-800 number saying, why am I getting something about mental health? And they had to explain to people. In fact, they had the right to mental health services whether or not they knew it or not because they're on Medicaid and that's a service of Medicaid. So, you know, there's a lot of things. I mean, I'm sure technically that's the same way in your state because consumer advisory boards, I mean, somewhere, there's a person saying, oh, let's placate the consumer. But if they do it right, the consumers should come out in mass. I mean, ideally, the general community who receives Medicaid should want to know, okay, Medicaid has to limit their money and how much they can service me on my physical health. Why? Because they're spending too much money. Well, how are they spending their money? Well, they're letting us know. You know, CABs are very unique to, I'm sure, each part of the state even, not just...
That's fascinating, Maria. And I'm wondering, Angela or Lester, do either of you know what DOH or DOMH's response to Medicaid is? Are these meetings broadcast to everybody who is receiving Medicaid?
I doubt it. I don't see that being feasible. I mean, what sounds like what Maria's talking about is more what we do at the state level, Lauren, where we combine family with us.
No. Where every single person is sent a notice of this public advisory meeting, right? Is that, Maria, is that what happens in Colorado?
I don't know if I can say it happens today. I know every mental health consumer today gets one. But I know at one point when I was regularly attending and very involved, they switched to a system that everybody who was on the Medicaid rolls, Now, we may be talking 10 years ago when I found this out. So I'm not sure it's still done today, but 10 years ago, every consumer who had Medicaid got this little, and it was, the newsletter is strictly a mental health newsletter, okay? And it gives tips about depression or...
You mean the government in Colorado? Wait a second, because this is a big issue. Because we constantly ask, like New York State, will you send this piece of information to everybody who receives mental health services or everybody who's on Medicaid? Know that that would break HIPAA.
Well,
we can't
you guys
do that.
Know. Well, I will tell you, in Denver, in Colorado, okay, which is the majority of the population of Colorado, just like New York City is the majority of the population of New York State, in the Denver and city and county of Denver, every member who receives Medicaid, they don't distinguish mental health or Medicaid. I mean, a lot of people, I mean, mental health services is just another clinic. You know, if I'm on Medicaid and I need to see a cardiologist, okay, or a GP or a mental psychiatrist, it's all being paid by Medicaid. So there's no separation. At the time also, and it's not the case now, that particular Medicaid company had the Medicaid contract for physical health and mental health. So it may not still exist today that way because, maybe 7 years ago or something, they got out of Medicaid, the physical Medicaid for everybody. They only do Medicaid for children and mental health Medicaid now, this particular insurance company, okay? So it may not exist that way now. But when I was involved about 10 years ago, give or take a year here, when they were covering both physical health and mental health, and adults and children, they sent it to everybody because they were the Medicaid supplier, okay? They did everything. But not today. They don't do everything today. But I do know... They do send it to the parents of children that they, because I don't know why they got out of adult medical care, but they did, and all they do is child Medicaid and mental health Medicaid now, this particular insurance company. But when they were doing the whole bottle of wax, everybody got one. I just remembered that. So
could
I
you
don't
imagine?
Know how it works today.
Could you imagine, Lester, Angela?
Yes.
There was a way to reach every single person in New York City who was involved in the public mental health system in this way and inform them that there's a consumer advisory board and that there are people who have lived experiences who are actively giving input and that this was a forum for people. Could you imagine having the access to people in that way? How different would this movement be? Part of the reason why the movement in New York, I'm sure, is as limited as it is because we have no way of finding people. We have no way of mass communication with anybody, and the government doesn't ever give any kind of indication that any of this is happening.
Well, also, Lauren, the fact that if more people knew about it, they may have to or be forced not in a physical manner, but literally forced to have CAB meetings in every borough or county within the city, or as well as within the state, because it would be so popular of a meeting if people knew there was a place that they could go and bring their concerns directly to the Director of Consumer and Family Affairs. At these meetings, I mean, I have handed written complaints to the Consumer and Family Affairs person. And mind you, these grievances and stuff like that often don't turn out for the consumer. But it is a process. It's our right to do it. Okay? I technically still have a right, and I may do it for a physical health reason, to make a grievance to the county Medicaid office about services that's not really being served. I mean, it really doesn't matter if your Medicaid is a mental health Medicaid or if you're using a Medicaid service that is a mental health or a physical health, wherever your problem is, you have a right to go to the Medicaid and file a grievance. Mental health was a little bit more what I was involved in, but everybody, and I mean, technically Medicare you can file a grievance too, but it's a totally different situation. But within your state, everybody has the right to file a grievance for mistreatment, inadequate treatment. Right now, for me, it's a transportation problem. Not even a problem. It's the provider isn't providing things legally. And I have the right to go to my local Medicaid office and file a grievance and say, this Medicaid provider is not following standards you have set for them. And, you know, the thing is those things people need to know if they're on Medicaid that that's an avenue. People don't like when I use this particular word, and the word is ignorance. I don't get offended by that word because I'm ignorant of a lot of things, okay? How planes fly, I'm ignorant of that. But people think ignorant means stupid or dumb. But out in the general public of people who receive Medicaid services don't know they have the right to file a grievance if they don't like what's going on. And it doesn't matter if you have a physical problem, a mental health problem. It doesn't matter. And we have the right for a grievance. And we have also the right to no retaliation for that grievance. That doesn't mean you won't get it.
Right.
But we have those rights. And people don't always take them. And it's hard because right now it is a physical problem, mind you. But the only reason why I haven't already filed a grievance is because this particular company is the only game in town, and if that company finds me to be a problem, you know, in Denver, when I lived there were 5 companies that did that, so I would just go to another company. I'd file a grievance and then switch to another company. I don't have that option here, but I still have the right. I still have a right to be treated with dignity and respect. So I think now that I'm talking about it, I'm going to go for it. Yes, I may end up not getting a ride to the doctors when I need it, but the principles are the same. I have the right to, when I'm in public transportation or Medicaid transportation, I have the right to be safe and secure, me and my property. I have that right. And when one particular driver drives me, that is not the case. And so I tried to report the incident without using my name, and that didn't work. So I will go and full ahead. And yes, I'm running risks of losing. At the very least, when I want to ride, it would be more difficult. But the fact is we have these rights.
Way out. In 2014 is just so sad, and it's wrong, and it's irresponsible, and the fear of retaliation to stop someone from being able to go after their rights and have their rights protected is just another.
Oh, and I told the case manager that I'm dealing with, which she hasn't done anything wrong with the third person, I said, I will tell you, I've told you about the situation, and if it isn't corrected, and there is an accident, and I am hurt more because I'm not my walker is not secured in the car, and there is an accident, and the walker hits me, and I'm injured more because of it, I'm going to sue you guys more, and I'll have every right, and instead of a small amount of settlement, I'm going to get twice and three times the amount. I'm going to go for it, not because I'm money hungry, but because I told you of the problem, and you're not acting out on it. So
well,
she
it
gave
just
me the
seems
name.
To me, yeah, I mean, this is just such a problem, because here is something clearly within the physical realm that is clearly marked, clearly measured, clearly identifiable and as a problem, and it's ignored. And yet things that they have not a drop of physical evidence for become, like, the most important order of the day. It's
right. Yeah, and believe me, I understand the fear of the consumer. I mean, for this young lady who was speaking earlier, I missed her name, for her to be able to speak out the way she has on your show or any show is a brave feature, because if there's the slightest chance that the person in charge of this particular cab doesn't like the way she talked or referred, or who's to say that what can happen? Oh, you know, I mean, with mental health, there's an extra risk if it's a mental health issue. I mean, I don't feel there's a mental health problem with my physical issue, but when you speak out about a mental health issue, whether it's your own private issue or the way the mental health provider is dealing with providing, you want those providers to be your friends, okay? And I tell you, I have friends who've seen me. I have filed grievances. I have filed complaints. And what they end up doing in the end is not answering my emails, not answering my letters, not answering my telephone calls. And then I have to go to the higher level. And basically, the higher level says we find it not substantial or not a problem. I mean, Lauren, if you can imagine this, the big new mental health center in Denver opens up, and every single office, therapist or doctor, has a floor-to-ceiling window in it that it can't be blocked. My therapist was told she can't put a plant in front of the window. It must be that people walking by can see through it. So I went to
You mean on the hallway side?
Yes. Yes.
I thought you meant, like, to outside.
No.
And I was waiting for, like, that bars had to be put up or something. On the hallway side, so that anybody walking down the hallway can see what's happening in the office.
Anyone, another consumer, another doctor, another therapist, the CEO of the company, a state representative, if they were to... mind you, the conference rooms are all windows, but all the conference rooms, the windows are frosted. So the windows on the very, very top and the very, very bottom aren't frosted, but anywhere within eye shot, you can't see who's in that room. But a private therapist or your psychiatrist, they refuse to frost the windows. Because part of the idea with the windows was to allow... it's supposed to be a green building, okay? Then I was privately told, I'm sure, so I would shut up. The reason why those windows were there was that some consumers had accused doctors and or therapists of sexual harassment, and this way they can prove there was no sexual harassment because It wouldn't happen in a room like that.
Still would happen, though. It could be covert.
It could be just verbal. What the hell?
It could be just a look of the eye.
Haven't they ever taken a sexual harassment training? Like,
Colorado
hasn't changed much. You guys sprung Joanne out of there.
I told him, I said, sexual harassment in therapy or doctors is as old as psychiatry itself, and it's never been dealt with that way in anywhere else. Why has it been dealt that way? So I went all the way, and I had the local state advocate, a nonprofit state advocate filing the suit at the same time. I had my private suit complaint grievance, and she had an advocacy group file a complaint at the same time to DORA, and that's the top in Colorado anyhow. I'm assuming it's that way everywhere. And they said the complaint was unsubstantiated, that it didn't violate HIPAA rules. Okay.
Having a window where anybody can see you actively engaging in some kind of psychiatric
treatment.
Relationship, forced or otherwise, didn't violate HIPAA? Yeah, that's sure. Because HIPAA is only there to protect them, so they don't need to protect themselves from who's working. That's public information, I guess, right?
Well, you got to remember, these weren't little picture windows. These were floor to ceiling, and that was what I was objecting to. Because I could inadvertently see people in the rooms. Just going to my therapist. You have to pass other therapists' office or other case managers' offices to get to yours. And as you're walking down the hall, you could see other people in the rooms. Okay.
It's like having a it would be like the equivalent of having a no-tell motel with front windows. Like, why? I don't mean to say that, like, it's totally flipped. This is, like, one of the most intimate situations of a person's life. How am I supposed to be able to feel comfortable to, like, really address things and be emotional and you know, share my deepest, most intimate, thoughts with somebody else and develop that trusting relationship with the idea that anything can be happening on the hall in the hall in front of me? And where does white noise come in terms of that? I mean, you know what I mean? Like the white noise machines that all the, therapists have to try to block it and create privacy. Where is privacy? How are you supposed to have any kind of therapeutic relation? And how could they say that HIPAA isn't infringed by that? Like,
how about people who could read lips?
Right. And they did have a whole section, or they still have a whole section for the deaf. So literally, you're correct. A deaf person could be walking by and be able to understand what was going on. The main point was these are blatant infringements of our rights. I mean, it's a no-brainer. And I was told it was unsubstantiated, okay? And I had a disability rights advocacy whole group, the statewide group, on my side, and it didn't matter. And that advocacy group was not a mental health advocacy group. It was a cross disabilities advocacy group. So it wasn't even that, because that group, it doesn't matter if I was in a mental health institution or an MD's office. Now, this particular mental health center has a medical clinic in it. And the medical clinic section does not have these windows, okay? So why would you not have those windows in the medical clinic if the only reason why you have these windows is to prevent
I know, because they generate enough green all on their own. They don't need to be any greener than they already are. They've got more green coming into them than...
So, you know, everything is very bizarre. And the thing is we do have a voice, whether or not we get heard, whether or not we ignored, whether or not it works out for us, is besides the point. If you don't use your voice, when you have a voice and you know you have a voice, that's the problem. And I just convinced myself that Monday I'm calling the director of the transportation company and saying, I'm sorry, it's only this one particular employee, and I'll write it down if I have to, but this is a formal grievance. A formal grievance. And let the chips fall as they may, because if I then still discriminated or the rules aren't followed, I have grounds for a legal civil suit against that company.
And people do have that power, and I think that maybe that's another whole show all in itself of how do you file a grievance? What are things that you can have grievances over? Really talking about and taking apart how this happened. Even bringing in, like, what Tina was talking about Minkowitz the other night was talking about shadow reporting. Let's start listing all of these things that are happening to people, all of the ways in which people are, being killed or potentially being killed. Because just because you happen to survive it doesn't make it any less heinous. And we need to remind people about this and continue to speak out. I can't believe that we're at the end of 2 hours here. And so we only have a couple of minutes left, so I'm just wondering if anybody's got any last thoughts that they'd like to say before we close out.
Well, I will tell you this. It sounds like, there is a difference when you get family and peers together. I mean, it really waters down the voice even further. We know that from New York State, from what's happened with us recently. And I think it's problematic, but when you're putting stuff in bylaws that just doesn't belong there, I think it's even more problematic. And if you're trying to either drive the voice down or silence the voice that you actually wanted at the table, it makes it even more problematic.
Yeah. Angela?
Hey, if there's anybody out there listening from Staten Island, put in an application for this cab thing. We need you.
Yeah.
I don't know where it's going to go. I'm anxious to see the final version of the bylaws that have already been approved before anybody has seen the final version. So,
Wait a second. It sounds like things that our government do, right? You've got to pass it in order to be able to read it. Just to call up Nancy Pelosi here and just let her know that this is, and everybody remember, Kennedy wants everybody to get a checkup from a neck up. Out at what's going to be happening at alternatives, what's coming down the pike. There is a severe move back to the biological brain disease model, and if Tim Murphy has his way, that's exactly where we're going to go. Everybody, contact your local elected officials, contact your local departments of mental health, find out what consumer or recipient advisory boards may exist, and get involved. And in the next few weeks, we are going to have some amazing shows coming up. There are people who have contacted me about setting up things about that and the things that are going on in the Southeast and in the Southwest. And so I am so looking forward to where we're going, and we're going to do a follow-up with Tina Minkowitz. If you have an idea for a show or would like to be a guest or know of a human rights violation that you think needs to be exposed, you can call the Talk with Tenney tip line at area code 718-273-8708. Maria, thank you again for calling in with your infinite wisdom about things, and the perspective from Colorado is just fascinating, and I think we can learn a lot, and I did learn a lot from you tonight. And Angela and Lester, thank you so much for bravely calling out attention to these issues and And I will be following up with you and seeing which way we go, but clearly the New York City Department of Health's Consumer Advisory Board is a public body and as such should be subject to public open meeting laws. And so thank you, thank you, thank you. And I really hope that people are going to be able to voice things and not be called violent and conveniently kicked out when they say things that are threatening to the master organization. Keep speaking out. Till next time. Talk to you soon. Have a good night, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you.